Lil, put aside the ego and embrace the moment.
It's time for another midweek drive transcontinental adventure.
It's always wondrous when we reach the time of the month where we can welcome Arthur Weingarten for his regular slot here from San Diego. Welcome, Arthur Weingarten. How are you?
I'm well, thank you. And you?
Very good, actually. Pretty good. I decided to actually avoid the invitation I had to actually visit Washington and sort of step up to the sort of seat of government, basically, because I thought it was a bit crowded. It's a bit crowded, really. I thought, no, it's all right. Sorry. Just step away from that, really.
Listen, I can guarantee you that you will have another opportunity or several.
Well, that's important, because also joining us today from the joys of his upper studio, wherever he's an artist, a writer, a keen producer, but also perhaps even more significantly, a great actor who actually, Arthur, started doing these radio shows with me back in the 1980s. I know that's nearly 40 years ago since he first actually started off this whole package. It's Rupert Baker. How are you, Rupert?
I'm very well. Very well indeed. So,
excellent. Rupert, of course, still...
I can actually see this now because my camera's on.
Last time you did what's referred to as a Jessica, which is fine, and yeah. You know, listen, it's perfectly okay. As we know, we had our wonderful actress Lee Purcell, who joined us on Wednesday, and she still remembers her time in Bonanza, Arthur. You'll be pleased about that. But Lee also went on camera alone, so it's perfectly okay because we don't know what's happening in North Carolina, do we, Jessica?
Nope, it's craziness all the time.
North Carolina is just so crazy. It's just unbelievable. Arthur, let's turn to your good self. Have you got any questions you want to put to Rupert or Jessica at this moment in time? As we also welcome Phil Learness, who is using his fashionable late time to actually arrive and say, I'm here, I've arrived, the show can now start.
all the fingers in the pots that you have going. It's amazing you can keep it together. No, I have no questions. I'm an empty vessel sitting here waiting.
But what a wonderful Zen-like opportunity to actually just...
I can run with that. That's
I can also formally say that I have pressed the button, I've pressed the link that Phil Lynn has sent me for his latest movie, The Lady... Killers, not to be confused, but that's the whole line. And yes, Phil, I can see the trailer perfectly well. I haven't quite got any further than that as yet, but the trailer is good.
Yeah, I know that works, Alex. And I need you to use the super secret VIP free code I sent you to test the rental on it, because then everyone internationally will be able to see the film that has been described as exactly the movie we need right now. The Lady Killers. I heard my dear friend Arthur say that he is an empty vessel and just sitting here waiting. My question is, Arthur, why are you reading the president's tweets out loud?
No. First of all, I think you forget that I don't use a computer. Ned has set this up, and that's the only reason we can see each other. Other than that, it's parchment and turkey quills for me, you know. So that's that. You made a movie? I didn't know that.
Oh, Arthur, I've made so many movies.
No, I mean now. I'm just talking about the lady.
Well, I mean, look, how am I going to continue to maintain my status as an underground cult failure if I don't, I mean, I have two choices. I either have to keep making movies or I need to sleep my way to the middle. So I make movies. But yeah, The Lady Killers, as Alex knows, has been a very lengthy ordeal for me. It was based on a script I'd written a long time ago. And a handful of years ago, a friend of mine, a colleague who would end up producing the film, said, it's time to make something really dark. He was sensing something in the zeitgeist. It's time to make a dark comedy. I had themes that I wanted to explore, misogyny, exploitation, I wanted to examine the roles these forces play in so much of entertainment and culture. And I thought to myself, who doesn't want to see a dark comedy exposing the reality of misogyny and exploitation? And the answer was, at that point, everyone doesn't want to see that. And then things started to shift with the Time's Up and the Me Too movement. And suddenly I had a film that was au courant. I was even asked at one point, did I make the movie overtly about Harvey Weinstein because of one of the characters in it? And the character is played by an actor, Ari Gross, who has so many credits, has forgotten more about acting than I will ever learn. And he has worked with Harvey and knew Harvey, so I have no doubt that he was calling upon some of those memories in embodying this kind of archetype. But no, we never had discussed that this is any kind of particular person, just indeed that this was an archetype. So the movie focuses on seven men, all mature enough age-wise to know better, who for whatever reason decide it's time to shake up their lives, and they get involved in a game of high-stakes romantic conquest, and the game goes wrong. Many crimes are committed, and pretty soon death rears its ugly head.
Under the genre of comedy, crime, and mystery, the IMDb statement, seven men, several crimes, violence, murder, mystery, misogyny. It is just a game. It is just a movie. It's just locker room talk. Almost the perfect movie, Phil, but I'm gutted. No place for Rupert Baker. I mean, I know we've done podcasts of this. We've featured the cast. We've featured a whole range of things, etc. I mean, you know, Rupert would have been ideal to actually put in the British villain role in this. I'm sure, Rupert, you'd have been up for this.
But it sounds like there's enough for five sequels there. So, Rupert, you've got your picture laid out.
Yeah, I certainly will.
Rupert, any questions you want to put to Phil, or indeed Jessica, or indeed Arthur? Over to you. It's your first time on a Zoom where you have your camera on. So go for it.
When can we see it? I've been watching a lot of things sort of down the line because, of course, we've got a lot of cinemas closed at the moment over here because of the pandemic. But when does your film actually come out?
Well, that's, I mean, the way that the world has changed within the last year finally made us realize, you know, why aren't we just making this available globally online for rent and to own all at one time? As you know, Rupert, so many films, no matter where they're made, it tends to be kind of piecemeal unless they're huge budget projects backed by a studio. But even then, many territories get them much later than their countries of origin. And so it has always been this kind of piecemeal distribution effort around the world. And finally, man, if we're ever going to leap in and say, no, let's take advantage of this technology that connects us, now would be the time. So there's a link that Alex has that once he tests it and tells me that it's working fine, we will be promoting the heck out of it on this show, won't we, Alex?
Of course, Phil. That's what we do. I mean, it's like a decade of fun we've been having. I know in comparison to Rupert, you're relatively new to the whole thing, but of course we will.
But if anybody wants to learn more about the film and can find the link soon enough, maybe even by the end of the day, they can learn more at theladykillersmovie.com, theladykillersmovie.com.
Okay, not to be confused with Alec Guinness or indeed Tom Hanks.
Well, geez, why do you bring up the Tom Hanks? You know, Tom Hanks, who doesn't love Tom Hanks? Everybody loves the Hanks. That's why we celebrate T. Hanksgiving here every year with a Tom Hanks marathon on Thanksgiving. But the one real negative against Tom Hanks is not that he was in the remake. No. That's who would ever want anyone to turn down a paycheck? We don't want anyone to do that. But he did an interview on David Letterman's show about the remake, And he referenced when Letterman wanted to bring up the original, a classic starring, for my money, one of the greatest actors of all time, one of my five favorite actors, Alec Guinness. And Tom Hanks said, Dave, nobody cares. Nobody's seen the original and nobody will. And oh, that rubbed me the wrong way, Tom Hanks. You're an international treasure, Tom Hanks. You are supposed to value the past.
You have to be more charitable. Everyone has the right to be stupid every now and then.
Yes. No, they have the, this has come up a lot in America this week, hasn't it, Arthur? Everyone is entitled to believe and think whatever they want to believe and think. I would fight for their right to believe and think whatever they want.
You know, Phil.
That doesn't mean that they get to do and say whatever they
want. That's absolutely right. But there is no one smart enough to take your advice at this moment.
Yeah.
Because... Yeah, no, I mean, all bets are off. There seems to be some seismic upheaval in which you have just normally vile people like the Republican Party en masse, vile people who normally just eat each other up. But now the virus has spread beyond that. And
there...
so, you know, we're infected. Throughout all the things.
Do I take it then, Arthur, that it's unlikely that yourself and Annette will be inviting the Trumps over to San Diego in the near future for a sort of general sort of chihuahua?
We just canceled the invitation. We did.
To a hanging.
Yes. Along with all of his other resignations, we've added ours to it.
Well,
I want to ask a question. This is now a serious question. Why did you name the film after, when you and I both know that Guinness is a classic film and anyone with half a brain has seen it 20 times? So,
Alex, say the title again.
The Lady Killers.
It's not the same title. There is a space between the lady
as opposed to and the lady killers.
As opposed to the Lady Killers, it is different. You know, I obviously there's a doff of the cap to it because it is to me one of the great comedies. And at the same time, the difference in the title is an important hint at understanding what's
That's
going
what
on.
That's what I was wondering
film.
If you were yeah. doing that. Yes.
Yeah.
So there is that kind of come on, like what will the difference be?
Now, you were just talking about seismic cultural shifts, and then you said, now I have a serious question, and you went back to my movie. I appreciate that, Arthur. This is why we're show business people. enough of the world burning.
Exactly
we have show business emergencies to
take. The rest of the world is a bi-com. This is where life really is lived.
So on that moment, let's bring in Jessica, because Jessica, you've probably actually done your research with Rupert. You realize he was born in Folkestone, Kent, following his parents' return from a mission field in Nigeria. Father was a doctor, mother a teacher, grew up in Deal. That's Deal or No Deal. I'm sorry, Rupert, I've been waiting years for that, but it is Deal. It's Deal. Jessica, who would you like to quiz or throw a general question out to?
I never like just singling out someone. Oh my goodness. Okay. I think I'll ask Rupert a question. I'm going to ask, what are you up to during COVID? What are you doing during the pandemic with any projects?
Well, the term used to be resting. There's kind of not a lot happening on the live front at the moment. Mm-hmm. We're all sort of mothballed, but I've been having a very good time. I have a filmmaker friend. We've been working on stuff. I've just moved house. I bought this place with a massive attic because I paint a lot on the side. So I've just been sort of getting on with that. And I've got to fix this joint up and rent another place. So it's all kind of all pretty good. And the rest of it will come back online when it does for all of us.
Yeah. What kind of art do you do?
I work very, very big. And I either work in a sort of realist way, you know, nudes, that kind of thing, or I do a lot of kind of memory paintings of almost like a sense memory thing. And I like very much to do big screens. So I sort of do triptychs, diptychs, that kind of thing. It's all over the show. But I mean, I've got a thing that I've it's been going on and on for a few years, but I've hauled it out again. It's a 12-foot long painting in three screens of a hospital that was condemned. And it's I've now got to get on and finish that. So I should nail it up to the wall there and work on it through January and put it to bed.
Has COVID kind of provided... Oh, sorry.
No, go on, Jess. Carry on.
I was going to ask, has it provided any inspiration for any art?
COVID? I bet that Arthur will sort of know about this. I bet everybody's got doing COVID plays and COVID screenplays and saying, oh, I've got a great idea and do something about a pandemic. Of course, the trouble is we're all probably sick to death of the damn thing in one way. And I certainly don't know that I want to go sit through something after the event. And, you know, lockdown, well, I mean, it's only a variant of resting. So you just sort of put your head in a certain place and push through.
Splendid. I mean, that is the quota of the pandemic, I feel, Rupert. Again, you've nailed it. Lockdown, well, it's only a variant on resting. It's genius. Yeah. I mean, to me, that's summed up so many sort of wonderful things. Death to 2020 is a movie on Netflix, which I would heartily recommend if people actually do want to find the ultimate sort of take on 2020, then watch Death to 2020. Yeah. It's only about an hour, but the input of Lawrence Fishburne, Tracy Ullman, and indeed Samuel Jackson, superb from that point of view. You're nodding, Phil. Have you seen Death to 2020?
Yes, I have. And it was very funny to me until... Well, I just literally got this text from one of my best friends. He just literally and sarcastically wrote me saying, wow, I'm so glad that 2020 has been so much better than 2020. I saw a meme recently. A friend of mine had created that showed the twins from The Shining, the two little girls. And one of the little girls was wearing a 2020 sign and the other was saying 2021. And they were saying, come play with us. So out with the old, in with the old is very much what we've been doing. But you are right about the documentary. It was fantastic. And when I allowed myself the dream of believing that turning a calendar page would get rid of COVID and get rid of everything that ails us, I enjoyed it so much more. Yeah, until I realized we're still in the dumpster fire.
That's true, but it's part of the rich tapestry. Rupert, over to you.
I'd love to talk to Arthur. I mean, you've done so much stuff. And how did you get started? What made you want to be a writer and how did you get into, because you wrote a lot for TV and you've done movies. And
I started out, my mother was in vaudeville and a radio singer. And so I had contacts through her. And I started out in radio as a young child. I was 8 years old. I started doing radio drama. And I quickly discovered that boredom from your end of the business was not what I wanted, sitting around waiting for other people to do things. And then you're on and then you're off for 2 hours. So I started making up stories in my head early on. I would read the scripts that we were given for radio shows. And I thought to myself, I could do that. And so I would start early on writing little stories, which went nowhere. But eventually I sold, when I was in college, to a live show, and DuPont Presents, it was called. And I was off and running.
Great. And how did, I saw you had input on Raiden and Entebbe, which is a fantastic film. How did that drift your
on
way?
Which, I'm sorry, I didn't catch that.
I saw that you were involved with Raid on Entebbe.
Oh, yes. Entebbe, yeah. No, that was another... I had a contact in Israel, high up in Air Command. And this fellow called me and told me that there was going to be a raid in Entebbe ahead, 24 hours ahead of time.
Yeah.
And that he felt there could be good, positive television or movie things for Israel. That was his idea with telling me that story. So I quickly went to Len Goldberg at ABC, where I was under contract at that time to do some shows. And he was very interested in wanting to make a deal with me, at which point several other people he told of this, and they quickly went to Metro and made a deal over my head. Right. And so I had absolutely nothing to do with it whatsoever.
But you're a special production consultant in the IMDb list, Arthur. So you know, got Radon Entebbe, special production consultant. I was just thinking, that's one heck of a show business emergency, though, to actually sort of use that.
What it was, please don't sue us.
Litigation in Hollywood. I mean, Phil will be shocked at that. Surely that doesn't occur. I mean, there's no lawsuit of the week.
No. I cannot tell you the number of times of things that I have been involved in which I've gotten special consideration for not suing.
I mean, I just love, I think you should just claim that that's because you were a special consultant on the actual raid, because there are so many films that there were three television movies made in 1 year. Based on that, there was the one we're talking about, but there was also Victory at Entebbe with Kirk Douglas and Burt Lancaster, for crying out loud.
Yes.
So I believe, and as we know, anything can be believed right now. So I'm going to the deep web. You can have your wife explain what the deep web is, Arthur. And I am going to spread the rumor that you were actually a special consultant on the raid itself.
And do you know, as a coda to this, the fellow who had called me was an air ace in Britain. I can't say his name and all that, but he was a British fellow, English fellow, who was a World War II ace, with fires and hurricanes. And because he and I had flown together several times in strange places, we formed this kind of informal, I'll tell you something, you tell me something. And so after that, he was found out to have, someone who was his enemy over there found out that he called me 24 hours ahead of time, and it was not good for him. It ended very badly. So here he was trying to do something good for his adopted country, Israel, and he got the short end after it.
I love that the two of you would exchange information. Like, you would get to ask him, you know, what special operations are about to unfold, and he would get to ask you, what was working with Bruce Lee like?
No. You know what I would tell him? This was the strangest thing. I had an office in Beverly Hills away from studio, so you'll know what this is, Phil, so where no one can find you and bother you, and, you know, when you're late on a script and all that. So I had a little office in Beverly Hills, in what's called the Writers Building on Little Santa Monica and Rodeo Drive. And I had a neighbor who was in oil exploration. He had an office there. And it turns out that he was no more in oil exploration than I was. He was a CIA agent for Israel.
Easily mistaken. I mean, how often are those oil explorers in Hollywood secret sort of Mossad executives?
He was an American fellow who had been for the CIA for many, many years, and he now was a secret agent for Israel. He would tell me some things every once in a while, because he knew I had this contact over there. And when he yeah. wanted something to go through, but with, yeah. with the no one knowing it could be attributed to him, he'd tell me and I'd tell this fellow in Israel.
I trust your appreciation.
We would sit in a restaurant called the Rangoon Racquet Club in Beverly Hills at 4:30 or 5 o'clock on a Tuesday. We would meet and he would tell me things, and then I would call this fellow in Israel.
I trust you, Phil. We are writing your next movie for you here and now. You know?
Rangoon Racquet Club sounds like a place where the whole raid itself should have been planned.
It was a wonderful place. It was run by a fellow who ran a bar in Manhattan where everybody, the whole world, would come through this place. And this man literally had fingers all over the world, and he opened this Rangoon Racquet Club in there. And it was a small, on Little San Monica Boulevard, it was a small place, and at any hour that you could find people from all over the world in there, famous, not famous, but the things that went on in there were just extraordinary, absolutely extraordinary.
In the film that I'm now writing, Rangoon Racquet Club is the setting. The maitre d' is played by Rupert Baker, but he's not just a maitre d'. He's also a problem eliminator for MI5. It's perfect.
There you are, you see, yeah, Rupert. Yeah, you time on and you already have a deal set.
Can I ask Rupert a question? Do we have time?
Of course, yeah, sure. Go, Phil.
Rupert, I know from your bio that your father was a doctor, your mother was a teacher. So education clearly very important in your family. I'm curious, how was their response to you coming home one day and saying, the artist's life for me? Were they supportive? Were they concerned? What was that experience?
Well, they were
like?
Eventually when they kind of got behind it. I think my father had some notion that I would be a priest, but I don't know why. it's wide of the mark. And my mother was fairly keen on amateur dramatics and had actually trained, but never her parents stopped her because it was very much the thing that you know, you had to have a career backup, which was why she did teaching as well as drama. And so it that never really worked out. She was given an offer by an agent of the day, but she said, no, I'm going off to be married. And so that kind of went west. But I don't know if she would have been tough enough for it or if it was what she really wanted to do. But she was sort of quite behind me. And I think my father in the end sort of fell into line. And I'd done a few things and I'd been moving more in the art direction, but I think people saw that I got a facility and I did have somebody come down and see a play and say, you know, we really advise that you should follow this as a career. And I just quite liked the buzz at that point of being on stage. So yeah, they were very supportive, but it was down to if I couldn't get the money for a grant and get a place, then that's it. Scotch.
Wow.
So and if memory serves, Rupert, I think back in 1980s, 83, 84, thereabouts, your agent was very keen for you to come and get some radio experience, which is where it all started, really. Marvellous.
Absolutely, yeah. Down at the Dulwich Hospital, yes.
Yeah, so we look... Yeah. And I can actually say for both Jessica and Arthur and Phil, of course, and the listener, that there are still people who talk about when Rupert Baker arrived in Middlesbrough in the northeast of England, because that was at the height, obviously, of the popularity of London's Burning and the series London's Burning, which was very much an epic sort of line where you were Malcolm the Fireman in, of course, this Jack Rosenthal-themed classic.
Yes. I'm meant to say something here, but it was great. It was a terrific experience. I loved doing it, but you can't do the same thing forever. You've got to, but I did 6 years with that, and I'm eternally grateful. It was one of the best television jobs I've ever had. Yeah, super.
Compared to the Soldier in Life Force, again, a whole different line.
Oh, I loved that as well. That was terrific, and I got one of my best screen acting lessons from Tobe Hooper after my first camera rehearsal. It's going to be 60 feet by 40 feet. You just sort of take it down, just just imagine you're lying. And yeah, it was great help. I always go back to that. You know, actors always want to act, and it's fatal. It's not the way forward.
Tough call, Phil. I mean, actors always want to act. Is that something that you've suddenly found? I know you actually appear in The Ladykillers as a psychologist, more than a cameo role. But is it something which you turn around and say, must remember this, actors, they want to act, step away?
You brought up two, as you are inimitable at doing, you've brought up two wildly different subjects and pretended they were one question. I will point out about my role in The Ladykillers, as with any acting role I've ever done over the years that worked, it only worked because what I'm basically doing on camera is directing.
Yeah,
I'm playing basically a director. So it works. I just move from behind the camera to in front of the camera and do the same thing. I don't know about that. I think the idea of actors want to act and sometimes you need to pull it down. I think it depends on your background, honestly. And maybe Arthur has had some experience with this as well. Depending on what an actor's background is, they may proclaim the same love, but ooh, I have found myself at times thinking to myself with actors, boy, actors always make choices. Why does this particular individual's choice always involve making himself as comfortable and relaxed on set as possible? If there's a chair, he'll sit in it. If there's a bed, he'll lay down in it. You know, there are quote unquote actors, depending on their background, who they don't want to push themselves. They don't want to go for more. But we always appreciate the actors that do, right? Because it's a lot easier and a lot more fun to reel someone in, to tone them down, if there's somebody who's willing to go for broke and take chances, than it is trying to pull something out of someone.
As you rightly said, Phil Linus, when we were chatting with Lee Purcell the other day, and Jessica was with us, of course, I thought I'd bring out the official Jack Lord Hawaii 5-0 mug, just to show that there was an actor who knew exactly what he was about. And Phil counters that with the Mirror Mirror Universe alternate Star Trek mug as well. Fantastic, Leonard Nimoy. But surely Leonard Nimoy and Jack Lord, it could have happened. Jack Lord was up for the role of Captain Kirk at one stage.
First Felix Leiter in the James Bond films, Jack Lord. Talent-free genius, Jack Lord.
It's very important to get good locations with your projects as well.
Oh, boy.
Alex, where in the world would you come to a Jack Lord tea mug or a coffee mug?
It took me a lot of searching, Arthur. It was my holy grail, and I felt that, you know, finally it needed to actually be achieved.
Yeah, well, good on you.
That's making a... That's making a market for the ultimate inconsequential.
It has to be said, as Phil Leader said, anybody who could actually act with his hair like that. I mean, it's no surprise Lee Purcell did not one, but two episodes of Hawaii 5-0.
I mean, Jack Lord's hair was more expressive than Jack Lord. I mean, that's... Which I, as you can tell, I mean, I admire.
Okay.
I was one of a vast coterie of people who were invited to see the pilot for that and then asked to write for the series. And the only notable thing that I can remember is that I fell asleep in the pilot and my friend had to shake me awake when the screening was over so we could leave.
Arthur, those 12 seasons of Hawaii 5-0 were classics. Not as much a classic as the 10 seasons of the remake, but you know, still classics in their own way. And book them down.
I remember the title sequence very well. It's sort of big fisheye lens and a plane going over and the belly dancing, but not much else. Yeah.
What more do you need, really?
that covers it, yeah. Or not, as the case may be.
Jessica, I get a sense, really, from these fine folk that we may not be covering Hawaii 5-0 as an episode of Resonance Rewind in the near future, but have you ever come across the series yourself?
I have seen clips. I know, like, our our band in middle school played the Hawaii Five-O theme for a concert, but I've never actually watched an episode.
Well, there's another New Year's resolution for 2021.
Yes.
I sincerely hope that you will remain a virgin.
Very good to understand you.
Hawaii Five-O is a rite of passage, I think. Any human being with a heart will go through, Arthur. We'll agree to differ on that one. But anyway, let us continue. Very briefly, Phil, any closing thoughts you'd like to raise at this moment with either the Jessica, Arthur, or Rupert? The kind of equivalent to Mission Impossible's Jim Phelps, Barney Collier, Cinnamon Carter, and Rolling Hand, of course.
You did it again. Like, now I'm swimming in references that I barely understand. I'm going to go back to the question that I wanted to follow up with Rupert. Rupert, even though we live in a time of such turmoil where I don't know if there are quote unquote stable careers to fall back on anymore, I still believe that for almost any young person who decides I want to pursue a career in the arts, in performance, it's still a challenging conversation to have with parents who love them and want to protect them and want to ensure their future. What advice would you give to a young person who is in the same position you were in all those years ago and has realized, boy, this might not be what my parents want for me, but this is what turns me on?
Well, it's a terrible thing to say, but your parents aren't going to be around forever. And if it's the thing that really floats your boat and you feel you have to do it, then you must do it. But you've really got to want to do the thing, because it's, as Arthur was saying, there's a lot of hanging about, and it doesn't always play the way you think it's going to play. So if you can walk away from it, then you shouldn't be doing it. But if you want to do it, then go for it, go for broke. And similarly, like painting or anything, if it's a mission, then you should go all out.
One of the things that I say when people ask me, usually parents with fear ask me about how their young, maybe, you know, their children want to pursue a career in the arts. I always tell them my advice is don't let them do it. Unless there's nothing that turns them on as much. Because it is hard and it will be painful. But as Gabriel Byrne once said, he said he would rather be a failure as an actor than a success at anything else. And when he realized that, there was no choice. The choice was made for him. And my experience is, if you have that kind of passion for it and you follow that dream, you may not meet and match all your ambitions, but boy, you will meet like-minded and like-souled people across the way, and it will lead to such a rich life. You'll get to share airtime with the likes of Arthur Weingarten and Rupert Baker, for crying out loud.
Well, absolutely.
Boy, you know how to suck up.
And that brings us finally, Jessica, to your role. Jessica, would you like to ask the last two questions to the team, please?
I would love to. Okay. Rupert, Arthur, and Phil, have you all had a reasonably interesting Zoomer link with us today?
Fabulous. Top line.
Absolutely.
Until the last, like, 30 seconds when Arthur called me out, I thought I was... I was going to have Alex submit this episode for every radio award until then.
And finally, Jessica...
I want to give Rupert one piece of advice, because undoubtedly he's such a good guest, you're going to have him on many more times, that he should have as his backing some of his paintings. I want to see his paintings.
Well, we're Feast of the Epiphany, so heading through 2021, and the average British soul has been planning to make three resolutions for 2021, with a fifth of us suggesting that protecting the environment is very much in mind when making their pledges. Now, to actually talk us through some of the ways in which we can actually maybe start implementing those New Year climate-oriented resolutions, we're delighted to welcome two fabulous individuals. First of all, Philippe Pernstick. How are you, Philippe?
Very well, thank you.
And of course, the wonderful Sophie Miller. How are you, Sophie?
I'm very good, thanks, Alex. Hello.
Excellent. Sophie, let's talk to you first initially in terms of, obviously,
we know we're going through lockdown three. Who knows how many more we've got in the pipeline. We've had, obviously, the fun times of 2020. And we do know that actually, indirectly, certainly the first lockdown showed huge impacts in terms of climate, air, and various other elements as well. So should we not just actually resolve to effectively have a complete lockdown for the full year, basically, and don't travel anywhere?
Well, that's one idea for sure. But actually, I think what this research tells us that OVO Energy has conducted is that a lot of us are planning on making resolutions that will positively impact the planet. And sometimes we're doing it without even knowing it. So for instance, things like the classic kind of dry January, give up alcohol, or veganuary, as it's become to be known when you try being a vegan for the month of January. They're things that people might be doing primarily for health benefits, but actually they have a knock-on, really positive impact on carbon footprint reduction as well. So I'd say, one of our kind of the thing that we believe at OVO is that actually you shouldn't have to make, if you don't want to, huge extreme kind of behavior commitments. The most important thing is that you start somewhere, and you start somewhere with a simple step or two or three even that can help you cut your carbon footprint from the comfort of your home.
I mean, Philippe, turning to yourself, obviously OVO Energy is the UK's largest independent energy provider. When you are actually sort of compiling this particular balance, I mean, I was fascinated by finding that the 4.9 million of us likely to be opting for a dry January could save the carbon equivalent of 270,000 flights from London into New York. I mean, that's quite a phenomenal kind of saving, really, just on the basis of, making that decision to go alcohol free.
Yeah, I think we certainly not at the point where we have that awareness of the carbon impact of all the activities that we do on a day-to-day basis. But in terms of reducing alcohol consumption, obviously, from growing the grapes or the barley to turning that into alcohol and bottling it, shipping it, and getting it through the shops, all of those aspects add up to the carbon footprint of the drink. I think beginning to get that awareness is very important.
And in terms of the top 10 most planned New Year's resolutions, obviously start practicing mindfulness and meditation, important. Reduce my carbon footprint coming in at number 9. Number 8, I would have thought it's going to be very challenging though, Sophie. Reduce digital screen time. I mean, obviously, what we're doing now is digital screen time, and the world would be a poorer place without it, surely.
Absolutely, yeah. But people are telling us from this research that OVO's done that they do want to reduce it because I think we're all feeling as though it's not necessarily so good for our mental health to be glued to our screens all day. And whilst when we're working from home, it's quite hard to make those kind of changes. Actually, a simple thing that we can do is when you get to the end of your workday, just really make sure you turn your laptop off. Don't just close the screen down, turn it off completely, because that way you'll be less likely to kind of check back on your emails. And number 2, you'll save carbon, because actually every minute that we spend on our digital devices has a carbon cost associated with it. So that might give people sort of an added motivation, really, to cut screen time, because we know it's good for their mental health. And also, increasingly, we can tell people that it's good for the planet as well.
Yeah, which certainly ties in with the 6th most popular resolution, doing more to protect nature, just below drinking less alcohol, spending more time in nature, of course, also connected within that, drinking more water, eating more fruit and vegetables, and starting to exercise. I mean, Philippe, these are all very laudable, very personable skill sets that are actually there. What would your advice be to kind of get people to stick with it, though? Because obviously, we might well be at a period where people say, yes, I've got to do that, etc. By the time we obviously get to the third week in January, usually it's a case of, oh, what the hey, I can't be bothered to switch my television off, I'll just leave it on standby.
Yeah, and when you, if you have got some resolutions like that, like keeping lights off as much as possible, or turning television off standby, then actually one good way of keeping up with that is actually having a smart meter in your home, because although a smart meter on its own doesn't save energy, it shows you very immediately what the impact of your actions are. So when you flick that light switch, you immediately see the effect of it on the smart meter display. And that's a good sort of way and an incentive to keep up with that.
And Sophie, as the energy spokesperson for OVO, I mean, is it a case of, well, thank goodness I'm working for a company like OVO, I don't really need to worry about other New Year's resolutions because I'm putting into practice what I preach. So what are your sort of thoughts been this year? I mean, are there any things that you're looking to work in from your own point of view?
Oh, no, absolutely. I mean, the good thing about working at OVO is every single day is a school day. You learn more and more about how you can reduce your carbon footprint. So for me, I am making an active effort to turn my laptop off because I think that's a good one for my mental health, but also my carbon saving. I'm also looking to embrace natural light wherever possible. So not always automatically switching the electric lights on if there's natural light to be embraced into your home, because that's good for your health too, good for your concentration, good for your sleep, etc., and saves on your carbon. And then I am doing the classic, the cliche one, I'm doing Dry January because I know it should make me feel better hopefully by the end of January. And I was really interested obviously in the research that OVO's done with the Carbon Trust that shows that can also have a positive impact on the planet. So I thought that's a great motivation, and I need to really stick to that one.
Yeah, absolutely. And Philippe, what about yourself? Any New Year resolutions which you said, yes, I've definitely gone for this one?
Yeah, my New Year's resolution was really taking more attention of the smart meter that's sitting in the corner of my room and not getting looked at that much. So that's definitely one. But I'm also looking to take the opportunity of actually. Being at home more, to make a concerted effort with my veg beds this year, and actually hopefully have a bit more success with veg growing than I have had in the past.
Fantastic. Sophie, where would you suggest people should go to find out further information about OVO Energy or indeed the Carbon Trust?
So we've written together a brilliant blog on ovoenergy.com/blog. So if your listeners head there, they can see the research that we've done unpacked, and also the some inspiration. Basically, if you haven't already set your resolutions for January, then there's some simple home-based resolutions you could think about making that really won't be hard to make, but that can dramatically reduce the carbon footprint of your home.
It's been fantastic sharing some thoughts with your good self. I should have checked this out in the pre-chat beforehand, Philippe, but is it Pern Stick or Pern Stitch?
Pern Stitch.
I thought it might have been just working through that. So for the moment, many thanks indeed. All the very best for 2021. Sophie Miller, OVO Energy spokesperson, and Philippe Pern Stitch, senior consultant with the Carbon Trust. Happy 2021.
And you too. Thanks very much.
Bye.
Well, it's an old maxim that exercise is good for you and laziness is not. Certainly a coronavirus isn't good for you. But it is interesting that since the pandemic, recent research by Bulk suggests that actually we're exercising more. It's good for our mental health and a whole variety of other aspects as well. And to talk about how these findings have revealed new aspects about Britain as a nation, we're delighted to welcome performance coach, psychologist, and general all-round wonderful person, Jamel Qureshi. How are you, Jamel?
You're very kind. I'm very good, thank you. I'm all okay. I'm not very exercising this morning as yet. I've been very busy, but I will get around to it today.
I don't know, Jamel. I'm sure you can multitask and do the radio interview and actually be doing Pilates or some such stuff from that point of view.
If you hear me out of breath, I'm jogging on the spot whilst we're talking.
Nicely done. And of course, we've also got the growth officer for Bulk. Of course, that's Elliot Dawes. How are you, Elliot?
Morning. Yeah, really well, thank you. And yourself?
Fantastic. Jamel, if we can turn to you first. I mean, were you surprised by these findings? I mean, again, the whole notion of people exercising more and obviously sort of focusing on that. And of course, not going to their gym because we can't go to the gym.
Well, do you know what? It's funny because when Bulk.com gave me the results of this, I mean, Elliot said he wasn't surprised, but I was. And I thought that people would be drinking more, sat in front of the TV a little bit more. Head in hands, thinking about how they can make this world better. But the researchers found that a third of the nation, 38%, have increased their exercise uptake during the pandemic. So people are out and about more and doing more. So it did surprise me. But I think that the research also shows that the fact that people are not just doing it because they want to feel healthier and be healthier, but it's also to deal with stress. So it's good for the mind to be exercising, it seems, if you look at the research, because the majority of people are choosing to exercise with their motivation being to mentally feel better, just as well as physically feel better.
Yeah, absolutely. 85% actually say that they actually feel and prefer doing their exercise at home. I mean, is that because, again, comfortable surroundings and we don't have to worry about those embarrassing shots in the mirror, shall we say?
Well, do you know what? I mean, I don't know how lazy we are as a nation or how active we are as a nation, but I think one of the problems that people have with committing to going to the gym or getting the exercise bike out the garage, dusting it off and getting on the saddle, is probably the fact that it takes a little bit of thinking and a little bit of doing. Whereas if we're exercising at home, then it's almost an easier commitment, isn't it? You can create some space and hopefully in your living room or kitchen or wherever and do something. So I think that the fact that the gyms are closed and people realise there's a need to exercise, we physiologically and mentally feel better, means that they're probably finding it easier to commit to do something if they're not going out of the house to do it.
Elliot, turning to your good self, were you surprised by these results? As a case of no, it's pretty much fulfilling what we'd expected, and people want to be doing their exercise workouts at home as opposed to away from home.
Personally, I wasn't particularly surprised. I mean, we commissioned the survey just because we wanted a sense check of what the kind of changing attitudes, and if indeed there were any changing attitudes to health and fitness as a result of COVID. And I guess the rationale was that as a nutrition brand, we wanted to be able to adapt to any changes and then switch more people onto the importance of nutrition. But no, not overly surprising. I think just generally the results were really interesting. The fact that more of us are exercising and more of us are exercising more frequently. I think the thing that stood out as perhaps the most interesting aspect overall was the motivation as to why we're exercising. So I think, you know, our assumption as a brand previously was that the majority of people, especially our customers, were exercising for vanity reasons around weight loss and building muscle. But what the research has actually shown is that people are now exercising more for the general benefits around physical health, mental health, a reduction in stress. So I guess it shows that people have taken a more holistic approach to their exercise as opposed to doing it for vanity reasons.
Now, Jamal, you're also a co-founder of Bulk, and looking at obviously the bulk.com website, you've got all sorts of wonderful things there.
Protein. I'm not co-founder, actually. Oh. Sorry, Alec.
Moving on from that, we'll adjust that in the editing process. Jamal, just turning to yourself, in terms of obviously the need for good, healthy sports nutrition, is it a case of it's all very well doing the exercising, but if you're not doing, you're getting the fuel to actually help with you, then you know, clearly there are problems ahead.
Definitely. So healthy nutrition is incredibly important. And the reason why is that it's all to do with energy levels. So once we start to feel better in ourselves, we'll be much more likely to be enthusiastic about committing to expending that energy on physical activity. We've got to look at holistic solutions. So if you think that 7 out of 10 people in the Western world are obese, and obesity makes you susceptible to the virus, 84% of people who have a job don't like it, which makes you stressed, and stress makes you susceptible to the virus. So exercise and nutrition are all there to make you healthier physically and make you healthier mentally. And I think there's not just the fact that, you know, natural supplements like bulk.com are good for you, but it's also the fact that there's something more ritualistic about it. You have your healthy foods in the morning, afternoon and evening, build your exercise routine around your eating habits, and it becomes a healthy lifestyle, much more so than an exercise regime. And that's the key to sustainably being successful in your health goals.
Elliot, since being part of the company, have you kind of noticed a big improvement in your own lifestyle as a case of, well, I'm happy to deal with the cheap growth aspects, but frankly, I just can't be doing all that exercising?
So I've been, I mean, I co-founded the company in 2006, and it was...
I knew there was a co-founder in there somewhere, Elliot. That's important.
Yeah, I know. You know, starting the company in itself was born out of a passion for the gym and sports and an active lifestyle in general. So I've always been a big user of our products and will continue to be. And they play a really important part in, well, my lifestyle, my family's lifestyle, and our customers' lifestyles as well. So I think that's something that will continue. And I think we've seen, just to build on what Jamil was saying, that in terms of how important nutrition is, we've seen from the research we commissioned at Bulk.com that there's around 60% of people are now actively checking packaging of foods for what nutrients they contain and what ingredients they contain, and just generally cooking healthier meals. And we've seen this reflected in our sales too, across our customer database. So for example, during the first lockdown, we saw spikes in sales of up to 1,000% on products like vitamin D and vitamin C. And then also a huge uplift in sales of healthy foods such as nut butters and egg whites and fruits and nuts and seeds. So I think there's a greater adoption and, I guess, respect of how important diet and nutrition is in terms of an overall healthy lifestyle.
And Jamil, we talked about the holistic approach to things. I mean, here we are in the third decade of the 21st century. We're in our third lockdown. We have obviously the sight of vaccination over the horizon, shall we say, other things that are taking place. Do you think that actually the importance of actually maintaining healthy mind, healthy body, which used to be the old maxim, mens sana in corpore sanis, that's actually going to be of increasing importance as we continue through the years?
I think it will be. I mean, if you think about, you know, what this virus has done to us, society, community, economies, in terms of governance, I think it's made us repurpose, reimagining and revaluing things that we thought were important that are no longer important. Things that we didn't value, we're now really valuing. Now, one of those things is mental health and physical health. And so, you know, I do believe that this will continue as a trend. Now, people will eat healthier and take nutritional supplements, and they will exercise more. And I think we're realizing the fragility of life, the fragility of our own mortality. That we've been affected in a way which is almost existential. It's been very hard for a lot of people in hearts and minds to deal with the way in which the world's changed. And I think that we need to build a more sustainable future where our communities, our families and ourselves are more robust as we enter it.
And Elliot, presumably you would recommend bulk.com as the go-to website to find out further details about this. And of course, there's a huge wealth and a huge range of supplements and so on.
Absolutely. So for anyone starting on a fitness journey, or perhaps they're already on a fitness journey and they just generally want to embrace a lifestyle that involves exercise, health, fitness, and really good nutrition, then bulk.com is absolutely the place to go. We've got a huge range of around 1500 products. So that's everything from protein powders to healthy foods, a huge range of vegan products, which is a really fast growing category for us. Vitamins, minerals, superfoods, everything you can think of that supports an active lifestyle. And then if people want a little bit more inspirational content, they can also visit our Instagram, which is @bulk.
Fantastic. Well, Elliot Dawes, Chief Growth Officer and indeed co-founder of Bulk, and of course, ace performance coach and psychologist, author and general quick, all-round wonderful person, let's face it. That, of course, is Jamil Qureshi, who's probably been exercising as we've been doing this interview. Many thanks indeed, and happy 2021, gentlemen.
Thank you very much, Alex. Have a great day.
Thanks for having us. Thank you.